Well, let's welcome Aristotle.
Thank you, Martin. It's a real privilege to be here from various angles. As Martin said, I come from California, and in California we don't tend to have buildings of this age. And so it's very special for me to be here in the middle of this Crusader church. I learned English as a second language. My mother tongue is American. And so it's also a privilege to be here and practice my English with you. And I'm also not an academic person, and many of you are, I suppose. So that's a bit daunting for me to appear in front of you. And I hope that some of my simple observations and ideas might be somehow stimulating and valuable to you. I don't know many of you. I don't know your backgrounds. I don't know who of you might be Christians or another religion or no religion. This is a church, and so you might logically expect that someone from a Christian point of view and worldview might speak here out of that worldview, and that is me. I am a Christian. As Martin said, I used to be a Zen Buddhist. Before I became a Christian, I was a human being. God made me a Christian, but before that, he made me a human being. And I think it's very important when you become a Christian not to forget that you are a human being, because you have much in common with more people on the basis of being human than you do on the basis of being Christian. So I'd like to remember that. And so I appear before you as a human being and also a Christian. Our subject is authority, freedom, and epistemology. I'd like to write on this paper what the authorities in your lives are. If you could just shout them out, I'll write them down. What are the authorities in your lives? If you have any. Pardon me? Work. Gravity. Law.
Parents.
Media. Worldview. What was it?
Yourself.
Scripture. Which scriptures? All scriptures.
The Bible.
But would you want to say Upanishads, Vedas, Grat, Quran, scriptures, or do you just want to say Bible? You want to say Bible. Good.
Desire.
The authorities in your life.
God.
Money, finance,
bills.
What about advertising? That would fit with media a bit, but it would be a special kind of thing. Shelter and conformity. Shelter. Conformity.
Any? Food.
Pardon me?
Food.
Food. Good.
Contentment.
Everywhere I go, I get quite a different list. It's always fascinating to see what people think of. The authorities in your life. Maybe we have enough. You'll think of others. I mean, if we have time, it goes on and on. We turn the page and we get more and more. All of these people and institutions and things have authority in your life. What is it that they have? What is authority?
Influence.
Influence.
Power.
Any special kind of power, like electricity or atomic energy?
It's control.
Controlling power. Power to control. Okay. Power to direct. Influence, power to control, power to direct.
Inescapable power.
Okay. Inescapable power to control and direct and the rest of it. Although some people do escape their parents. Not many escape gravity. So some of them are inescapable, certainly. Anything else? What is authority? Inescapable power, influence, to control, direct.
It appeals to your respect, something that appeals to your sense of what is right.
Something that appeals...
Not just power. Authority is something more than power. Authority is something which...
Does it. That's an extremely positive and optimistic thing to say, and I hope you're correct.
It's a difference between just power. Power forces you to do things. Authority, you do things more willingly because you feel that there's some legitimacy. Authority has to do with legitimacy. Power, which has legitimacy.
Okay. That's an interesting...
Because if you assent to something, you're on board, seeing it positively, not just sort of led.
So authority is something that you are willing to be shaped by, but something that you're unwilling to be shaped by that actually shapes you, like Hitler or Stalin or the Politburo in Moscow or something, would certainly shape your life. But would we call the Politburo in Moscow an authority for the Russian people, or would we say it's not an authority because it's not willingly followed? I'm just searching here.
Controlling.
So, well, and someone said control, that authority is the power to control, whether a person wants to be controlled or not, perhaps. Would be authority.
But then things in brings a bit of that.
Yes.
I think it's something under which you can face yourself in voluntary or
voluntary or involuntary. You place yourself or you are placed willy nilly, perhaps.
If you go to that to the end concept, it could be one or
the other. Oh, it could be one or the other. That's interesting. Good. Over here? Right. So it often does happen like that. But I think there are exceptions to that also. So for instance, parents have authority over young children. They have authority of diet, don't eat only chocolate, authority of bedtime, to describe bedtime, authority to describe where to play, in the garden, not in the street. And the children are famously unwilling to submit themselves to this authority. And at the same time, that authority is necessary for the child in order for them to survive, because they cannot describe reality for themselves in these ways. They don't have the scope of vision or the experience or the wisdom. In order for them to survive, they have to have parents to have authority over them, to shape reality for them, and they're often extremely unwilling. But the authority of the parents, the motivation is good. Now, parents make mistakes, and sometimes it's not good, but even if it is good, the children still can be violently opposed to the goodness of the authority of the parents. May I suggest a possible definition, that authority might be the power to describe reality? And it comes my idea comes from the word. If you divide the word here, you have author. And that is the root of the word. The author is the one who originates, who writes the book. So if Martin writes a novel, and in it he says, George, I hope none of you are named George, George was an alcoholic. And Ian reads the book, and he says, Martin, I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's nice at all to say that George was an alcoholic. I don't think he was an alcoholic. Well, then Martin has to say, my dear friend, you're completely crazy because I am the author. And if I say George was green with five legs, then he's green with five legs because to this novel, I am God. I am the author. So there is a great power in author to authorize, to write the book, to write, to describe reality. So let me turn the page and move on quickly because I don't have much time. I'll put this watch here for your comfort. To epistemology and touch perhaps on freedom because that's in my title. The authority of parents shapes the freedom and guides the freedom of particularly young children so that they can live. So the freedom that is a living freedom is a freedom that has form, a freedom that is not an amorphous cosmic gas cloud of shifting focuses and sands. It is not a willy-nilly, according to the mood of the moment kind of freedom. It's a freedom in the context, in the interface, in complementarity with form. And then the freedom is a living, a lively freedom. But I offer you an equation. I'm not a mathematician, but I've made up an equation. Total freedom equals death. Now, I realize that's politically incorrect in a postmodern culture where the highest value is freedom. To say that total freedom, the extreme end of freedom, is certain death. But it seems to me that that's quite true. So if you give your children total freedom, they will not survive. You have to have authority. You have to give them form for their life. Because if they try to live in total freedom, they will die. If a society tries to live in total freedom without any forms of marriage, family, traffic laws, financial regulations, regulations on what drugs are safe and can be sold, if there are no forms to the freedom, we don't survive very long at all. Total freedom is certain death. But if there is no freedom, there is no life. There is just paralysis and some sort of a machine clicking along automatically. That's not life, that's only existence. So freedom is essential for life, for a human being, but it must be in a complementary relationship, in an interface with form, or the freedom becomes deadly. And what we tend to do, I think, is to pendulum swing back and forth between form and freedom in various sizes of swing. So we have historical swings that can take centuries, and we have societal swings that can be more rapid, and we have personal swings that can happen several times an hour. That I crave the form, the security of the form. And then I move over to the freedom. And I don't find a really good balance between the two very often. There's always a tension, there's always a struggle, there's always an unbalance, there's always an overemphasis, there's always an incompleteness, there's always an out of focus in the relationship between form and freedom. I have too much of one or too much of the other, and then I have the opposite the next day or in another area of life. So I might have excessive form in my academic life and excessive freedom in my sexual life or my friendship life, my societal life. And these things shift. And it's very difficult to get the whole picture stabilized and dynamic. You see, if it's only stable and not dynamic, it's dead. But if it's only dynamic and not stable, it's chaos. So how do we get the picture right with the dynamic stability? So moving along to epistemology, you have this diagram with the four circles. Maybe I won't put it on the board. It's on the other side of your paper, probably. This is an idea that I developed a few years ago, and after I developed it and had been lecturing on it for a while, I discovered that Charles Wesley developed the same thing a couple of hundred years ago, but I really did develop it myself, and I was just encouraged by the fact that Charles Wesley also did a very, very similar thing. What this stands for is authoritative sources that inform and shape and enable our knowledge about reality. And it's from a Christian point of view, but when I say Christian, I don't mean traditional, historical, religious, or churchy. I mean the biblical Weltanschauung, the biblical worldview. So at the upper left, you have B for Bible. The Bible claims to be God's word, and it claims to be his story, his meta-narrative, if you will, that talks about God and his creation and humans living in that creation, and tells us things that we would not be able to find out scientifically, and that we would not be able to find out sociologically. It tells us things that we can know that we would not be able to discover in any other way. So it's essential to a comprehensive epistemology to have the Bible, or you can say revelation. Then the R corner is for rationality. We have minds. If the Bible is true, God is rational and he gave us minds, and we are responsible to observe and to notice relationships in reality, ratios, rationality, and to shape creatively how these things interface and relate with each other. We're responsible to discover with our mind how things are and how they work. And we discover things with our mind that the Bible does not tell us. So, for instance, the Bible makes no mention of dentistry. But people have developed rationally and scientifically dentistry. It is an extra-biblical phenomenon. But I don't think it's evil because of that. I praise the Lord for dentistry, although most of us hate our dentist, and it's a blessing that we despise and avoid. But it's not biblical, you see. But that doesn't mean it's not true. So the knowledge of dentistry, the epistemology of dentistry, comes in the R corner and not in the B corner. So the B corner is essential because it tells us things we would never find out in any other way, but it's not sufficient. But you may be a bit shocked to hear me say that. It's not sufficient for our epistemology. We need the R corner as well. Then in the lower right corner, you have I for institution. And it is the institution of the family, the institution of the society, the institution of the church. So the Old Testament and the New Testament speak about people knowing God and loving God by knowing and loving each other. John says in his first letter, it's ridiculous to think that you love God if you don't love your neighbor. And you know that you love God by experiencing your love for your neighbor. That is how you know it. You don't know it by a vision or an emotion or just levitating or whatever else it may be. You don't know it by being religious and by doing a lot of ceremonies and being disciplined. You don't know that you love God in those ways. You only know it by loving your neighbor. So the institution, the family, the church, the society that is dynamic in history, and the knowledge is accumulative in the institution. We don't reinvent the wheel. We have creeds. We have definitions. We build on things from our ancestors. In the functioning and in our participation in the institution, we learn things. The institution has authority to inform our epistemology in ways that are not available in the R or the B corners. So the I corner is essential as well for a comprehensive epistemology. In the lower left corner is E for experience. We need to have personal, individual experiences of nature, of humanness, of love, of God, of healing, of guidance, of knowledge. We need to have personal experiences of thankfulness and praise and awe and fear and sorrow that we don't get from any of the other corners. We need these personal experiences. So this is called the cheese lecture because B-R-I-E spells brie, which is a kind of French cheese. And it is also the La Brie lecture. It's the La Brie lecture. So that's the small joke behind the thing. If you do the square backwards, you have the beer lecture. And if I give it in German, then I do it that way. If I do it in French, then we have the Brie lecture. Now, my basic thesis is that each of the corners are essential, that none of the corners are adequate, and that each of the corners are dangerous and can malfunction, especially if they're not in the context of the other three corners. Then we get in trouble. One of the big difficulties that I see in human life is that we each have a favorite corner. And we tend to group ourselves in that corner and put most of our eggs in that basket and either ignore or downplay or fear or avoid another corner because we don't know anything about it or because we had a bad experience in that corner, we were manipulated in that corner, or we experienced a failure in that corner or a frustration in that corner. So then we avoid that corner. And we concentrate on the corner that is already strong. And here there is an amazing wisdom in the Bible. Paul tells his readers, strengthen what is weak. And that is spiritual. To strengthen what is weak is spiritual. To strengthen what is strong is natural. It's a perfectly natural tendency that everybody has. If your R corner is strong, live there. Strengthen it. Invest yourself in it. Profit from it. market it, sell it, be identified by it, strengthen what is strong. Never mind the weak bits. They're embarrassing. And Paul says, no, no, you will die. You will become totally lopsided if you do that. That's already strong. You need to strengthen what is weak. And this is a very difficult piece of advice to take, because in order to take this advice requires humility and trust and faith in order to begin to strengthen what is weak. Because we don't see very clearly the value of the weak things. We see, we walk by sight in the area where we're strong. But we have to walk more by faith in the area that is weak. But this is Paul's advice. Strengthen what is weak. And I think it is good advice, but I find it exceedingly difficult to take that advice and to actually deliberately strengthen what is weak. So in terms of religions, various religions go into one corner or another. So the revelatory religions would be Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Mormonism. They would be people of the book. And the rationalistic religions would be communism and humanism, principally. That would go into the R corner and want to neglect revelation and personal experience. They would work it out mathematically and philosophically and have a theory and a manifesto, and then they would make it work according to the theories of Karl Marx and the vision of Mao and Lenin and Stalin. It's a more rationalistic religion. It's very religion, very, very religious. The I religions are the religions that are nationalistic, Shinto, Judaism, religious organizations that have a name of a people or a nation or a country or a language in them. C of E, for instance, Pache, would go in that direction. And experiential would be Hinduism and Buddhism and perhaps charismatic Christianity. Then in the area of Christianity, the evangelicals would tend in the Bible corner, and the liberals would tend in the R corner, and the institution would be the Catholics and the Orthodox, where in terms of the concentration of authority, the evangelicals would say the Bible is the original source. The Orthodox would say the institution wrote the Bible. So the institution is the original source and the original channel, the primary way of knowing through the institution. And so you have Holy Mother Church. This is the ground. And then the church, through the church comes various forms of revelation, for instance, the Bible and other things. So that the Bible is the second step. Whereas with an evangelical, the Bible would be the first step. There would always be some sort of hierarchy, putting one corner of the square first. And in the E corner, you would have the Pentecostals and Charismatics, who understand the Bible not in terms of what it says, but in terms of how they experience what it says, which would make them a bit postmodern, wouldn't it? That they probably wouldn't think of themselves as postmodern, but they would be, because it would be an almost pure reader response truth. The meaning of the text is my response to the text. That's very, very classically postmodern. So the Pentecostals and Charismatics were quite ahead of their time, in some ways. I don't know if they would take that as a compliment, but it's just an observation. So that's basically my little presentation, that it seems to me we have these four corners, which are perhaps not totally comprehensive, but they cover much, really, a great deal of how we know and what has authority to inform our knowledge. They are each essential. They are each dangerous. They are each inadequate. And my encouragement is that we try to include all four in our knowledge of ourself and the reality around us. Now there's a line going in the middle of the square, this cross, and so you have two axes. And on those axes, it's not written, but I would have two approaches to the Bible and to reality as a whole, and they would be the well approach and the story approach. The well approach to the Bible is to draw things out of the Bible that I need: information, comfort, guidance, accusation, correction, these things that I need, and apply them to myself. That's using the Bible as a well, that I draw out things. The story approach to the Bible is to look at the whole Bible as God's story of reality, God's presentation of the shape of himself and his creation, and the flow of the creation through time in history. The focus of the well approach is me, and the focus of the story approach is God. It seems to me that both are essential. I don't think we can just say, no, I'm just going to focus on God and I don't really exist. This, I think, is really not helpful. You do exist, and you need to love yourself and take care of yourself. You are real. You read the scripture. You live in the creation, and you need to apply various epistemological bits and principles to yourself in order to make choices in your own life. But if you do that outside of the context of the whole story, you don't know who you are. You're alienated and isolated, and you're just an entity, a thing, without true relationships, which means there is no meaning. But sometimes I plague my students. People, students say, what does that mean? What does, or does this mean that? And then I ask them, what does meaning mean? Oh, that's a headache question. What does meaning mean? And they go and break their heads on that one. I'll spare you. Meaning means relationships. Nothing has meaning in itself. The color red has no meaning in itself. It only has meaning in relationship with blue and green and brown. Then it has meaning. In itself, it's just a thing, no meaning. And to take it to the highest level I can think of, the meaning of Jesus Christ is not in himself. In himself, he has no meaning. He only has meaning in relationship to the Father and the Holy Spirit. And that is the nature of reality before there was space and time. That is the nature of the fundamental absolute of all reality, meaning in relationship. So if I isolate myself and I just have the well approach, I have less and less meaning. But if I only look at the story and I forget myself, then I have meaning, but I don't have existence. And neither one of them are recommended by me. But I recommend that we have both, and that we see that the relationship between the well approach and the story approach is not competition. It is complementarity. The relationship of many opposites is complementarity in reality. So light. Light is a wave and light is a particle. And depending on how you look at it, it is only a wave or only a particle. And it's very difficult to look at it and see both at the same time. But we know it is both. But the relationship of the wave and the particle of light is not competition. It's complementarity. They need each other in order to have the meaning and reality of themselves. Or on another level, marriage, which is the principal image, an example that's given in the Bible. Is marriage more masculine or feminine? It depends on if you're a male chauvinist pig or a liberated woman, then you would have a different view of these things. But most people would say it's equal. It is, in my view, but it is not 50-50. Because if you take away the woman, you don't have 50% of the marriage left. It's 100% the woman. And it's 100% the man. It's a 200% reality. It cannot be put on a flat bar chart and understood. It's a three-dimensional 200% dynamic reality that cannot be held still. It cannot be put in a test tube and analyzed. It cannot be expressed numerically, which would be the scientistic view that anything that is real can be expressed numerically. When you look at marriage, you realize the marriage is real and it cannot be expressed numerically. The relationship is mysterious. It is real, but it is beyond a flat equation. It's beyond three-dimensional stochastic calculus. It's bigger, more complex, richer than analysis can explain or demonstrate. Because it's a 200% dynamic relationship. And it's the same with our relationship with God. So if we belong to God, is it because God chooses us or because we choose God? Well, God chooses us 100% and we choose God 100%. But you see, we have difficulty coping with that because of the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution, which is very numerically oriented and it's a very encyclopedic approach. So the main project of the modern movement was the encyclopedia, to walk a circle around knowledge, the encyclopedia of knowledge. We will contain knowledge and put it on these flat pages of the encyclopedia, and then we will have it. Well, the project failed, and so now we have postmodernism instead, because the modernism didn't really achieve what it was hoping to achieve. But we have a very strong modernist heritage, and some of you are old enough to be modern people, although it's very old-fashioned. Most of you are probably postmodern people. I'm mixed up. I'm ambidextrous, modern and postmodern. You see, in the modern view, we know things by putting it flat and making a chart, a bar chart or a graph or some kind out of it, and then we know it. And when that part of the world culture osmoses into the church in the functioning of the fact that the world is the salt and the light of the church. Now, Jesus said something similar to that, but he said it the other way around. He said the church is the salt and the light of the world, but he doesn't get what he wants. What happens is The world is the salt and the light of the church. So we have the Enlightenment, and we have the encyclopedias, and we have the scientific revolution. And all that comes into the church, and the theologians begin to see things on flat surfaces in terms of 100%. So they have the circle, the pie chart of salvation. So is salvation predestination or free will? Is it God's choice or my choice? How does that work? So we put the question on a flat surface, and then we say, well, maybe it's 50-50. No, that seems disrespectful. It can't possibly be 50-50. I wouldn't worship the other 50%. So maybe it's 51% God and 49% me. But somehow that's not really... Maybe it's 99% God and 1% me. But that seems a little bit silly. That's not really a conclusion. Maybe it's 100% God and I am a zero. I'm a puppet of some kind. Or maybe it's 100% me and God is on holiday in some sort of deistic view of things. We see it never really works out. It's never satisfactory. And so all that people do is they just fight over this. No, it's this way. No, it's this way. But in Hebrew thought, and in my thought, actually, it's a 200% reality. You have 100% free will, this plane, and you have a plane of 100% predestination, God's choice, my choice. And they interface in a complementarity and form a three-dimensional sphere of reality in which both are 100%. And there is no competition. I don't know if that appeals to you, but it's very appealing to me as the shape of reality as we live in it. It's the shape of marriage. You have the man and the woman. It's 100% the man, 100% the woman. And there's a complementarity and a new reality of the couple, of the marriage. And ideally, the relationship is not competition. In a sinful world with fallen people, it is competition. This is very regrettable. And the Bible is not surprised by this fact that marriage functions imperfectly. The Bible is very well aware of that, that there are problems in it. But the ideal is that marriage functions very much like the relationships of the persons of the Trinity function, in a complementary wholeness of a complete being and participation of each person in a complementary interface, which is different from a modern or a postmodern view. The modern approach to epistemology or the postmodern view of epistemology, it seems to me, would be smaller, less complete than a biblical view of epistemology. And that's one of the reasons the Bible is so interesting to me, because it makes a three-dimensional reality, which includes the well and the story. May I take another minute and write something else? Is that all right? I don't want to go over my time, but suddenly I want to write this. You have well and story. And then, if you have pairs of opposites, I'll give you pairs of opposites, and you tell me whether it goes under story or well. Objective and subjective.
Subjective pairs in the well.
Subjective goes in the well, and objective goes in the story. Particle and wave. Particle and wave. Wave is well, and particle. Now this is one outside the box that you might not be able to answer. Yin and yang.
If you don't have a background in that, it's difficult. Pardon me? Yes, you knew that. Okay. Yin and yang. Predestination and free will. Predestination is the story. And free will. Left brain, right brain. You physiologists, med students, psychiatrists. Left brain, right brain.
Left brain is story.
Left brain is story. Yes, left brain is story. And right brain as well. Now, which side of your brain would you rather have? I would recommend both sides equally. So maybe that gives you a sense of what I'm trying to say in these columns. Husband and wife.
Controversial.
Mysterious. Let's see. Form and freedom.
Form is story.
Form is story. So which is more important, form or freedom? They're both more important. Yes, I agree. So both sides of this chart are essential and equally important. And in a modern view that wants to have epistemological certainty and control and mathematical numerical expression of reality, these sides are in competition with each other. But in a biblical worldview, they are not in competition. They are in complementarity with each other. They need each other to complete themselves and to make a total reality. So art and science, you have science over here and art over here. And through the history of universities, there's been this huge controversy of the arts against the sciences. In competition for funding, in competition for respect, in all kinds of competition, not realizing that to have a full life, a full epistemology, a full humanness, they need each other. That life and learning and expression are 100% art and 100% science. Sorry, I'm doing it the other way around. And we damage ourselves, we reduce ourselves by putting these two in competition with each other. We cause unnecessary suffering and ignorance and alienation by seeing it in competition, whereas in a biblical worldview, they're in complementary relationship with each other. Accurate truth and non-accurate truth. I would put accurate truth over here and non-accurate truth. Now, what do I mean by non-accurate truth? See, in the modern world, there is no non-accurate truth. In the modern scientistic world, there is no non-accurate truth. But in the modern artistic world, there is non-accurate truth. And in the biblical world, there is non-accurate truth. By non-accurate, I don't mean inaccurate or false. I just mean it is not accurate. So for instance, in the Bible, it tells us there was a Babylonian empire and Nebuchadnezzar was the king. That presents as accurate truth, as fact. And you can do archaeological and historical research, and you can find out whether or not there was a Babylonian empire and whether or not there is any record of Nebuchadnezzar. And if you find out nobody ever heard of Nebuchadnezzar, then the Bible's accuracy is in question and you can doubt its truth. But if you do find it, it's a verification of the truth. So that is accurate truth in the Bible. But on the other side, the parables of Jesus are not accurate. You cannot do research and find out the name of the mother of the prodigal son.
You cannot even find out the name of the prodigal son because he never existed. Jesus made him up. So the truth of that parable is not accurate, but it is deeply, richly true in another way than the truth of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire and the Battle of Carchemish, or, you know, whatever detail there is. So do you see what I mean? There is accurate truth and there is non-accurate truth. You could say historical and non-historical, but I think it's more than that. Accessible by scientific measurement also. So, but historical, non-historical would be good. Although the parable was given in history, and you can, by historical sociological research, isolate the century and the continent of where it happened. So there's an historical element in the parable, but it's still not accurate. It's still, you can't nail it down. I'm going to Romania next week. I've been there many times, and a few years ago I was in Cluj-Napoca, which is the capital of Transylvania, at a Christian cafe called the Quo Vadis Cafe, which I think is a good name for a Christian cafe, the Where Are You Going Cafe. And they had a series of meetings called Interface, where Christians and non-Christians came together for a discussion, and they asked me to go along and lead one of the discussions. There were about a dozen people, half Christian, half non-Christian, and the Christians were a psychologist, a psychiatrist, an architect, a nurse, and a philologist. Good. And the non-Christians were a professor of dentistry, a city planner, a brain surgeon, and an historian. Good. So it was an interesting group of people. Well, the Christians sort of felt the host group, so they started the discussion. And they started talking about the nature of faith and its capacity to influence history and life. And we were having, sit if you like, we started having a discussion, and people were saying one thing and another, and all of a sudden the brain surgeon, who was a very bright young man, sort of blew up, and he said, "Oh, you Christians, you're so silly and so stupid." He said, "All of your experiences of faith and vision and information and revelation, I can reproduce all of those in the laboratory and in the surgery. Everything. There is only physical reality. Don't be silly." And he went on and on. And I didn't really understand everything he was saying, so I stopped listening. And I prayed. And I said, "Now, God, someone needs to say something to this man, and I have no idea what to say. So if anyone is going to say something to him, you need to clue someone in how it might work." And then he stopped talking, and I opened my eyes, and I knew what to say somehow. And I said, "You speak as a man who was never in love." And he turned red. So, being not a shy person, I said, "Are you in love?" And he said, "Well, yes, I am." And I said, "And can you reproduce your relationship with the woman in the laboratory and the surgery? And does she know that?" And he said, "You got me." I said, "It's good to be God. Do you want to tell us that your relationship with this woman is reproducible?" He said, "No, I don't want to tell you that." I said, "Well, we don't want to tell you that our faith in God and that relationship is reproducible." So then we had a good talk. But we need to look at things holistically, and what in ways that I would call realistic. What is the nature of reality? Is it numerical, period? Or are there other elements of it? And we all experience other elements of reality that are not subject to numerical description. They're non-accurate truth. But it doesn't mean that they're not true, and that they don't need to be taken into consideration in our epistemology. And it doesn't mean that there isn't any authority that can tell us how to understand these non-accurate areas of our life. And the Bible takes all of this into consideration. It takes agriculture and economics and sociology and psychology and marriage and history and government and military situations, to take all of these elements of life into consideration, and puts them in the context of a creator God who is one, unity, and three, diversity, who is form. The three persons are not identical. The form of the Son is in some ways the opposite of the form of the Father. The form of the Father is to command and to send. The form of the Son is to obey and to go. Opposite forms. And they're both equally God. So in being faithful to the form of obeying and going, the Son is free to be God and the Savior of the world. Outside of that form, there's total disaster. So the freedom of God is in a complementary relationship with the form or the forms of God. So the way we experience reality is not different from God. It is very similar to God. God doesn't say, I live in total freedom. I float around in my heaven like a cosmic gas cloud of love. And I just have absolutely no restrictions or shape to my being at all. But you, my creatures, you must live in form and you must conform. And you are different than I am. No, he says, I have form and I have freedom. And I make you in my image. So you have form and you have freedom. I have responsibility to be faithful to my choices and my character. I am a promise-keeping God. I do not lie. I keep my promises, even when it hurts very much. And if you consider the account of the Garden of Gethsemane, it hurts very much. So you are made in my image. You keep your promises, even when it hurts very much. And if you don't keep your promises, there is death. There is alienation. There is isolation. There is not life. And there needs to be restoration, redemption, forgiveness, remaking of reality when the death is produced. So I hope you can get my picture of reality, authority, and epistemology, with the complexity of reality, and then the hope in the biblical declaration that of the opening of the letter to the Hebrews, that all things are held together by the power of the word of Jesus. All things are held together. So when we look at this, we look at these four circles, and we think, whoa, how can I manage? No, you cannot. Never mind. Don't worry about that. There is a God who has made reality in this shape, and he can manage, and he promises to manage. And we can accept his authority and live within his managerial system, if you will, and have life, which involves freedom and form, not only freedom, not only form. So now I've talked longer than I should, but would you like to ask questions or make comments? Or I have had more freedom than form.
I have to admit one thing I was looking to hear about your conversion.
Ah. I don't mind telling you something about that. The question for the recording is something about my conversion from Zen Buddhism to Christianity. I don't really like to talk about myself. I find myself not very interesting, but because I see myself from the inside, I guess. I became a Christian for a variety of reasons, and one is it became clear to me that it takes less faith to believe in Christianity than to believe in anything else. Not more faith. But when I read the Bible, it seemed to me this is a system of reality, an understanding of reality that is more comprehensive and more evident than any other system. It's more comprehensive than materialism, it's more comprehensive than transcendentalism, because it's both. It's transcendent and immanent. It's material and immaterial. It's both sides of this. And most systems lean on one side or the other. And you can believe them, but it takes more faith to believe a system on one side or the other than it takes to believe a comprehensive system. I don't know how much you know about Zen Buddhism. It's more and more popular, and so people know more and more about it. But in
Japan.
Oh, so you've met it for sure. Yeah. Every religion, Zen and any other religion, is practiced in a variety of historical, sociological, therapeutic ways that don't necessarily show us the absolute presuppositions underneath them. So the therapeutic practices of the various religions can be identical. And they are all effective in therapy in a variety of ways. So the Christian religious practice of being in community and discipline and feasting and fasting and the rhythm of the year, that's very therapeutic. That's very healthy to live like that. And if people live like that without believing, it's still therapeutic. So the Zen Buddhist or the Hindu or the Baha'i rituals and patterns of life and exercises of bowing and lighting candles and going on pilgrimage and bringing offerings and things like that, it's all therapeutic, physically and psychologically and sociologically therapeutic. It all produces some measure of health. And so Zen Buddhists don't tend to be unhealthy people at all. My former Zen teacher is still living. He's 101 and he's still working. He's still teaching. So that's admirable. And it's just remarkable, actually. But I'm interested in the absolutes, the system, the whole picture behind. Little children ask absolute questions like how high is up or how far is far. The impossible questions, the absolute questions. And I never grew up. And I think that's part of what Jesus meant when he said, you have to become a little child or you won't belong in the kingdom of heaven, because that's what the kingdom of heaven is like. Asking the impossible questions and reaching beyond the stars for understanding that this is the life that God offers us. And little children understand this, and adults who are sophisticated and expert have much more difficulty understanding these things. Well, Buddhism is a monistic religion, not monotheistic, but monistic. So a monotheist believes in one God, and a monist believes in one, in a total unity with no diversity. The Zen Buddhists are a bit more extreme. They're not monists, they're nonists. They believe in nothing. But it's not a negative nothing, it's a positive nothing, it's a pregnant nothing. So I can illustrate. We can say it is possible that it will rain tonight. And that is true. But the possibility is nothing. The possibility is real. It's not false. It's real. It's actual. And it is nothing. Everything that is, every object, every person, every thought, every emotion, every imagination is possible. There's nothing that is not possible. Is God possible? Is the devil possible? I mean, I know we tell our children you're impossible, but it's not true. They are actually possible. Everything that is possible. So possibility is the mother of everything. Possibility is pregnant with everything. And possibility is nothing. The deepest truth I know of Zen is Buddha is possibility. Buddha is not the fat guy painted gold in the restaurant. That this is our image of Buddha. That's crude and misleading. It's not. Buddha is possibility. So when Siddhartha Gautama was enlightened, he realized possibility. He realized the pregnant nothing. And when he opened his eyes, he saw the planet Venus on the horizon, and he knew he was enlightened because he knew he was looking at himself. Because all is one is a very crude way of saying it. The Zen Buddhist would say tathata, suchness. So when I studied Christianity, I was reading the Bible and having discussions and thinking through different things and asking questions like, why is God? And does God choose the aspects of his character, or does he discover himself that way? Various childlike, impossible headache questions. And I'm a musician. And when I studied in college, I sang in the Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, The Mikado, and I sang Pooh Bah. And Pooh Bah's first aria begins, why are you who asked this question? And that played like a tape in my head for weeks. And then I thought, well, maybe I should pay attention to this question. It's the Jewish question. Who was asking? So I'm asking all these questions, and then I'm facing, who is asking? Who is asking? So I considered that from the Buddhist and the Christian angle. And I realized the Buddhist answer is, asking is. And the Christian answer is, I am asking. Forever. My whole experience of life has been asking questions. I have no conscious memory of not asking questions. And that was, somehow it really resonated with me that in the Buddhist worldview, I needed to abandon the me of asking questions and the relationship of asking questions and become one with the possibility of asking is. Which is very attractive, because in the pregnant nothing, in the total unity, there can be no suffering, there can be no desire, there can be no disagreement, there can be no alienation, there can only be perfect, unnameable bliss. This is attractive, very attractive to very intelligent people. But I looked at that, and then I looked at Christianity, and I thought, no, the Christian absolute is reasonable. Form and freedom, unity and diversity in the original truth behind all reality, that is a reasonable absolute. And it takes less faith to believe it because it is closer to my experience of myself so far. That was one of the main motivations of becoming a Christian. And then another real reason and answer is the work of the Holy Spirit. We shouldn't avoid that. So I became a Christian through the work and power of the Holy Spirit, which is unintelligible to lots of people. It's just voodoo kind of idea. But honestly, I must say that because that is part of the reality. But the other is also part of the reality. my search and the questioning and the asking who is asking and following up, pursuing truth in that way was also a very real part of my becoming a Christian. That's part of the story that I
wrote. I have a question about your four parts diagram, which I found really helpful in the book. But I was wondering whether it actually underplays the role of the art of the institution, and that actually by presenting the four dimensions as somehow equal or equivalent, I'm wondering if it would be more accurate to put the institution as the primary vehicle or means by which people enter into religion, and it's really a question of which is given the institution that you're in, how do these other three play out?
Very interesting. A very interesting question. Different people have asked that question, favoring different corners. So 2 weeks ago, I gave this lecture in Switzerland, and there was an evangelical Bible scholar who said, you mustn't put it like this. You must put it like this. Maybe I have the diagram. You must... I must have it. Yes. You must put it like this, with the Bible here and the trickle down, or you must put it here with the Bible as the foundation and everything built upon it. Well, I am an evangelical, and I love the Bible, and I'm a pastor, and I'm a preacher, and I said, this is my natural tendency to do that, but I resist it. I don't trust my natural tendency. And so I put it like that. I put it like it is. I gave this lecture in Gdańsk at the Naval Academy in Gdańsk, the great seaport in northern Poland. And all the officer candidates that were hearing the lecture were, of course, Catholic, because Poland is a Catholic country. And when I gave this lecture and I had it on the board, and when I said that the four corners were equally essential, they were on their feet shouting. Because I had insulted Holy Mother Church, which is the ground of everything. And it was just a blast against me. It was really strong. And I sympathize with your question because the institution is essential. And I don't want to diminish that in any way. The institution is a sine qua non. It is absolutely essential, and it cannot be ignored, it cannot be pushed into the background, but I think the other corners are also essential. And depending on your favorite corner, you can start with any corner and show that the others are dependent on that corner. But it seems to me a sounder approach to say that they are all essential. And that their relationship is not derivative, but complementary. Because if we say that the relationship is derivative, we will fight wars over which corner is primary. And we have. There have been bloody wars fought over this. But if we say they are all essential and the relationship is complementary rather than derivative or competitive, we may come to some sort of stability and peace. So that's why I come. Not that I don't have a prejudice. I do. I mean, you would put the institution as the keystone. I would put the B corner as the keystone. But I don't trust my natural tendency to do that. I don't trust a lot of my natural tendencies because they're out of focus. They're off kilter. I try to look back and to see, well, what really is the shape of reality? And if I am a sinner, if I am distorted and covered with the dust of death and twisted by sin, my own and other people's, as the Bible says I am, then I should expect my view to be out of focus. which is not a very encouraging thing to say, but I think it's a real thing to say. I should expect my desires, my natural tendencies, my prejudices to be out of focus, off kilter with reality, and I should try to imagine how could that be contextualized in a full reality. And when I imagine that, I come to this unilateral, equal corner kind of system. Not that they're equal in function, they're very different from each other. And not that they are interchangeable, they're not interchangeable. You can't replace one of them with the other. They're all essential and distinct and unique, but none of them are independent. And none of them are first. You don't begin with one and then move to the next and move to the next. They're all primary. They're all original. Now, it's very nearly 9:30.
We have time for one,
more question.
I hesitate to ask this because it's going to make me sound like a name dropper. On Hitler's latest trend in theology, maybe it's a math anyway. Well, a lot of what you're saying sounds like this concept of the postmodernism at the beginning of what was called the emerging church. I think it's fine. Do you follow this or are you aware of it?
Not closely.
Okay, because, yeah, if you find Frank or a wonderful book by Frank and Rick called Beyond the Foundation of Shipping Postmodernism, Shipping Theology and Postmodern Context, lots of stuff like this, not the down to the fix, it's great. But I'm saying this stuff is out there. And it's just a good thing.
Yes, I'm not really familiar with the emerging church. I know people involved in it. And I don't know how much of my material might appear in other forms with other emphases within the emerging church teaching and writing, but it's very interesting to me. Thanks. Oh, that certainly could be true. Because we are shaped by our ignorances. And our preferences are shaped by our ignorances. Because we strengthen what is strong. And that is what the Bible would call walking by sight. But to strengthen what is weak would be called walking by faith. And we naturally walk by sight. And we spiritually walk by faith. And that's the opposite process. That's a very good question. Thank you. So we draw a dotted line, and I hope perhaps we can continue this on another page someday. Thank you very much, and God bless you.